Welcome to Life in Debt, your practical debt education program. This is bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak. I'm speaking from Crew LP 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa. An award-winning, listener-supported, open-source, grassroots, and partially solar-powered community radio station broadcasting from the Cultural District in Fairfield. Please note that these presentations are provided as a public service for general information purposes only and are not intended to be legal opinions, legal advice, or complete discussions of any legal issues. Remember, every individual's factual situation is different, and you should seek independent legal advice from an attorney familiar with the laws of your state or locality regarding specific information. The name of this show is Life and Debt, and it is a weekly half-hour educational show looking at all types of issues related to debt as it influences your life. This show provides practical, general knowledge about what to look for regarding debt, what are traps and pitfalls, and what to do to be an educated debtor. Get some notebook, paper, and pen so you can take notes during the show. First, we look at some debt-related news and facts for the week. From Peter Goodman of the New York Times, in hard times, lured into trade school and debt. One fast-growing American industry has become a conspicuous beneficiary of the recession, for-profit colleges and trade schools. At institutions that train students for careers in areas like healthcare, computers, and food service, enrollments are soaring as people anxious about weak job prospects borrow aggressively to pay tuition that can exceed $30,000 a year. But the profits have come at substantial taxpayer expense, while often delivering dubious benefits to students, according to academics and advocates for greater oversight of financial aid. Critics say many schools exaggerate the value of their degree programs, selling young people on dreams of middle-class wages while setting them up for default on untenable debts, low-wage work, and a struggle to avoid poverty. And the schools are harvesting growing federal student aid dollars, including Pell Grants awarded to low-income students. If these programs keep growing, you're going to wind up with more and more students who are graduating and can't find meaningful employment, said Rafael Pardo, a professor at Seattle University School of Law and an expert on educational finance. They can't generate income needed to pay back their loans, and they're going to end up in financial distress. For-profit trade schools have long drawn accusations that they overpromise and underdeliver, but the woeful economy has added to the industry's opportunities, along with the risks to students, according to education experts. They say these schools have exploited the recession as a lucrative recruiting device while tapping a larger pool of federal student aid. They tell people, if you don't have a college degree, you won't be able to get a job, said Amanda Wallace, who worked in the financial aid and admissions offices at the Knoxville, Tennessee branch of ITT Technical Institute, a chain of schools that charge roughly $40,000 for two-year associate degrees in computers and electronics. They tell them, you'll be making boku dollars afterwards, and you'll get all your financial aid covered. Ms. Wallace left her job at ITT in 2008 after 5 years because she was uncomfortable with what she considered deceptive recruiting, which she said masked the likelihood that graduates would earn too little to repay their loans. As a financial aid officer, Ms. Wallace was supposed to counsel students, but candid talk about job prospects and debt obligations risked the wrath of management, she said. If you said anything that went against what the recruiter said, they would threaten to fire you, Ms. Wallace said. The representatives would have already conned them into doing it, and you had to just keep your mouth shut. A spokeswoman for the school's owner, ITT Educational Services, Lauren Littlefield, said the company had no comment. The average annual tuition for for-profit schools this year is about $14,000, according to the College Board. The for-profit educational industry says it is fulfilling a vital social function.
supplying job training that provides a way up the economic ladder. When the economy is rough and people are threatened with unemployment, they look to education as the way out, said Harris N. Miller, president of the Career College Association, which represents approximately 1,400 such institutions. We're preparing people for careers. Concerned about aggressive marketing practices, the Obama administration is toughening rules that restrict institutions that receive federal aid from paying their admission recruiters on the basis of enrollment numbers. The administration is also tightening regulations to ensure that vocational schools that receive aid dollars prepare students for gainful employment. Under a proposal being floated by the Department of Education, programs would be barred from loading students with more debt than justified by the likely salaries of the jobs they would pursue. During a recession, with increased demand for education and more anxiety about the ability to get a job, there is a heightened level of hazard, said Robert Shireman, a deputy under Secretary of Education. There is a lot of Pell Grant money out there, and we need to make sure it's being used effectively. The administration's push has provoked fierce lobbying from the for-profit educational industry, which is seeking to maintain flexibility in the rules. The stakes are enormous. For-profit schools have long derived the bulk of their revenue from federal loans and grants, and the percentages have been climbing sharply. The Career Education Corporation, a publicly traded global giant, last year reported revenue of $1.84 billion. Roughly 80% came from federal loans and grants, according to BMO Capital Markets, a research and trading firm. That was up from 63% in 2007. The Apollo Group, which owns the for-profit University of Phoenix, derived 86% of its revenue from federal student aid last fiscal year, according to BMO. 2 years earlier, it was 69%. For-profit schools have proved adept at capturing Pell Grants, which are a centerpiece of the Obama administration's efforts to make higher education more affordable. The administration increased financing for Pell Grants by $17 billion for 2009 and 2010 as part of its $787 billion stimulus package. 2 years ago, students at for-profit trade schools received $3.2 billion in Pell Grants, according to the Department of Education, less than went to students at two-year public institutions. By the 2011-2012 school year, the administration now estimates students at for-profit schools should receive more than $10 billion in Pell Grants, more than their public counterparts. Those anticipated increases may shrink depending on the outcome of wrangling in Congress over health care and student lending. Enrollment at for-profit trade schools expanded about 20% a year the last 2 years, more than double the pace from 2001 to 2007, according to the Career College Association. Mr. Miller, the association's president, said for-profit schools were securing large numbers of Pell Grants because their financial aid offices were diligent and because the school served many low-income students. But financial aid experts say the surge of federal money reaching such institutions reflects something else: their aggressive, sometimes deceitful recruiting practices. If you're just tuning in, this is bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak, and this program is Life and Debt, your practical debt education program. I'm speaking from Crew LP 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, and beyond. And I've been reading an article by Peter Goodman of the New York Times about being in hard times and lured into trade school and debt. Continuing the story, Jeffrey West was working at a pet store near Philadelphia, earning about $8 an hour, when he saw advertisements for training programs offered by WyoTech, a chain of trade schools owned by Corinthian College, Inc., a publicly traded company that last year reported revenue of $1.3 billion. After Mr. West called the school, an admissions representative drove to his house to sell him on classes in auto body finishing and upholstering technology, a 9-month program that cost about $30,000. When Mr. West blanched at the tuition, the representative assured him the program amounted to an antidote to hard economic times. They said they had a very high placement rate, somewhere around 90%. That was one of the key factors that caused me to go there. They said I would be earning $50,000 to $70,000 a year. Some 14 months after he completed the program, Mr. West, 21, has failed to find an automotive job. He is working for $12 an hour, weatherizing foreclosed houses. With loan payments reaching $600 a month, he is working 6 and 7 days a week to keep up. I've got $30,000 in student loans, and I really don't have much to show for it, he said. It's really frustrating when you're trying to better yourself and you wind up back at square one. Corinthian says it bars its recruiters from making promises about pay. The majority of our students graduate, said a spokeswoman, Anna Marie Dunlap, in a written statement. Most see significant earnings increase. The increase in market opportunities for the for-profit education industry comes as governments spend less on education. In states like California, community colleges have been forced to cut classes just when a demand is greatest. This is creating a very ripe environment for the for-profit schools to pick off more students, said Lauren Asher, president of the Institute for College Access and Success, a nonprofit research group based in California that seeks to make higher education more affordable. The risks of exploitation are higher, and the potential rewards of those practices are higher. For-profit culinary schools have drawn long criticism for leading students to rack up large debts. Now they are enjoying shrinking growth. Enrollment at the 17 culinary schools at the Career Education Corporation, most of them operated under the name Le Cordon Bleu, swelled by 31% in the final months of last year from a year earlier. When Andrew Newberg called the Le Cordon Bleu School of Culinary Arts in Portland, Oregon, to seek information, he was feeling pressure to start a new career. It was 2008, and his Florida mortgage business was a casualty of the housing bust. An associate degree in culinary arts from a school in the food-obsessed Pacific Northwest seemed like a portal to a new career. The tuition was daunting, $41,000 for a 15-month or 21-month program, but he said the admissions recruiter portrayed it as the entrance price to a stable life. The recruiter said, "The way the economy is with the recession, you need to have a safe way to be sure you will always have income," Mr. Newberg said. "In today's market, chefs will always have a job because people will always have to eat." According to Mr. Newberg, the recruiter promised the school would help him find a good job, most likely as a line cook, paying as much as $38,000 a year. Last summer, halfway through his program and already carrying debts of about $10,000, Mr. Newberg was alarmed to see many graduates taking jobs paying as little as $8 an hour washing dishes and bussing tables, he said. He dropped out to avoid more debt. "They have a basic money-making machine," Mr. Newberg said. Career Education says admissions staff are barred from making promises about jobs or salaries. The school requires students to sign disclosures stating that they understand that its programs afford no guarantees. But promotional materials convey a sense of promise. "Our students are given the tools needed to become the future leaders in the industry," proclaims the Le Cordon Bleu website. "Many graduates have attained positions of responsibility, visibility, and entrepreneurship soon after completing their studies." The job placement results that the school files with accrediting agencies suggest a different outcome. From July 2007 to June 2008, students who graduated from the Culinary Arts Associate Degree Program landed jobs that paid an average of $21,000 a year, or about $10 an hour. Oregon's minimum wage is $8.40 an hour. The job placement list is cited in a class action lawsuit filed against the Portland School, previously known as Western Culinary Institute, by graduates who allege fraud, breach of contract, and unlawful trade practices. Executives at Career Education denied the allegations while asserting it would be wrong to judge the school on the basis of its graduates' first jobs. You go out in the industry and work your way up, said Brian R. Williams, the company's senior vice president for culinary arts. On a recent morning at the campus in Portland, hundreds of students donning chef's whites labored in demonstration kitchens stocked with stainless steel countertops and commercial gas ranges. A chef inspected plates and students melted and pulled sugar into multicolored ribbons. Others used a chainsaw to sculpture blocks of ice into decorative centerpieces. It's employable skills. That's what we teach people here, said the school president, John Alberts. We try to give them as much of an industry experience in the classroom as possible. But several local chefs said the program merely simulated what students could learn in entry-level jobs. When they graduate and come in the kitchen, I tell them, I'm going to treat you like you don't know anything, said Kenneth Giambalvo, executive chef at Blue Hour, an upscale restaurant in Portland's Pearl District. It doesn't really give them an edge. What the school does give many students is debt, often at double-digit interest rates, debt that even bankruptcy cannot erase without a lengthy, low-odds legal proceeding. When T.J. Williams arrived in Portland from his home in Utah to enroll at Le Cordon Bleu in 2007, he was shocked by the terms of the aid package the school had arranged for him. One loan for nearly $14,000 carried a $7,327 finance charge and a 13% interest rate. They told me that halfway through the program, I could probably refinance to a lower rate, he said. When he tried to refinance, the school turned him down, he says. Career Education declined to discuss Mr. Williams' case, citing privacy restrictions and saying he had not signed a waiver. Mr. Williams has been jobless since last fall and recently returned to Utah, where he moved in with his mother. So the bottom line here is you need to be very careful when getting student loans. And remember, they generally are not dischargeable in bankruptcy. Only extreme hardship permits a discharge, and that is after a lengthy hearing. If you are just tuning in, this is bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak, and this program is Life and Debt, your practical debt education program. I'm speaking from Crew LP 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, and beyond.
So now I'd like to continue on and talk about the two-income trap, why middle-class parents are going broke. This is a work by Professor Elizabeth Warren and her daughter Amelia Warren Tiagi. I start with an important credit because the thoughts, ideas, and examples used in these programs are directly from or based on the work, theories, and books of Professor Elizabeth Warren and her daughter. They are two of America's leading champions for debtors. I highly recommend their books, All Your Worth and The Two-Income Trap. You could also visit and review all of my past shows at www.kruufm.com. Look in the archives under Life and Debt, and you can get a full sense of what this show is about, what we have been discussing regarding debt, and how to help people out. Now I'd like to get into going it alone in a two-income world. We talked a lot about the different issues regarding two parents working, but Professor Warren starts with a story. Gail taps nervously on the table as she talks about 12 years of marriage to Brad. The litany of complaints comes easily to her lips. She's told the story before. Brad drank too much. He didn't pick up after himself. He always forgot birthdays. But after a few more jabs, Gail exhausts herself and her face softens. Brad loves his kids. On weekends, he would lie on the couch for hours with little Caitlin sound asleep across his lap, the drool just sliding all over his shirt, and he never even minded. How could you hate a man like that? After more than a decade of marriage, their life together began to unravel. They outsourced Brad's job at the distribution center. No severance. Nothing. Gail was working hard, too tired to be very supportive. She missed Brad's mood swings as nothing more than a male ego type thing. But then Brad started disappearing, spending his days and then nights away from home. The anger bubbles up again as Gail recalls. Money that was allotted for daycare started disappearing. After a few months, Brad found a new job and his dark moods lifted, but the damage was done. Gail learned the reason for Brad's disappearances. He had been seeing another woman. Today, Gail looks back reflectively. He felt like I didn't need him. He lost confidence in himself. He found somebody to cater to that lack of self-confidence. Gail says it doesn't matter so much now, but at the time, all she could think was that he had found some other woman beautiful, had put his hands on someone else. She said, I swear I could smell her on him. It made me crazy. She screamed, threw his clothes in the yard, and broke his baseball trophy. Brad didn't hang around for more. He found a new apartment and invited his girlfriend to move in. Gail was worried about making it on her own with three children, but she figured that she was pretty well suited to make a go of it. Brad let her keep the house, and he didn't intend to fight her in court over anything else they owned. He was hoping to keep the legal bills to a minimum. Gail says, with an embarrassed laugh, we got one of those TV guy divorces that we agree on everything kind. Besides, Gail was a good provider in her own right. She had a degree in communications and 9 years in the human resources department at Exxon. By the time Brad moved out, she had been promoted to manager, and thanks to an awesome raise, she was earning $46,000 a year. In short, Gail had about as much going for her as any modern middle-class mother starting her newly single life could hope for. She figured that she and her kids could make it. So up to now, we have been looking at and expounding on nearly every aspect of financial life of the modern middle-class family. But we haven't addressed all middle-class families. In fact, we've been silent about the families who are most often in the news for their financial woes, those who first come to mind when the phrase parents in financial trouble comes up. That is, of course, the single mother. Conventional wisdom holds that the single mother has a tough time making ends meet. There are some single fathers, of course, but the overwhelming majority of custodial single parents are women. So we have to start the discussion with them. We'll talk about fathers later. Generations before America had dreamed of a government-sponsored welfare program, charitable foundations offered their assistance to widows and orphans based on the widespread understanding that a woman with children would have a tough time getting by on her own. During the divorce explosion of the 1970s, the spotlight turned from the widow to the divorced mother, but the concept was basically the same. Without a man around, a woman with children was in big trouble. In the 1980s, sociologist Lenore Weitzman made headlines with her claim that in the immediate wake of divorce, a woman's standard of living drops by 73% from her married state. Several scholars later showed that Weitzman overstated the extent of the decline, but there is widespread agreement about her basic conclusion. Most mothers tumble down the economic ladder after they divorce. Nor is the post-divorce financial tumble a phenomenon confined solely to poor women. In fact, the hardest drop is for women in the middle and upper classes, since they have farther to fall. A generation ago, with the emerging power of the feminist movement, women's groups began to push what seemed like an obvious solution to the economic woes facing divorced mothers: help women get more money. According to this logic, single mothers would be safe only if they earned more money in the workplace and if the laws were changed to squeeze more out of their ex-husbands. The first item on the agenda fit neatly with advancing the cause for all women, regardless of marital status. Women should get more job training, better educations, and stronger legal protections in the workplace, which should all translate into one thing: bigger paychecks for all women, single and married alike. The second objective focused directly on the rules of divorce. Women's paychecks should be supplemented by generous child support awards from their ex-husbands,
which should be rigorously enforced by every sheriff's department in the country. The double prescription, make more and collect more, promised to lift the single mother from a precarious state of dependence and bring her the financial security she so desperately needed. So Professor Warren asks, was the women's movement right? She says this is one of those rare social theories that we don't have to debate in the abstract. The past generation has been a giant laboratory for testing exactly the get a job, get child support, and be safe prescription. All we have to do is look at the evidence. So over the past generation, millions of married women have embraced the protect yourself strategy. Going to college, getting a good job, and staying in the workforce has come to be seen as the only sensible way for a married mother to protect herself in this age of rampant divorce. The conservative social critic Danielle Crittenden observes, I don't believe placing a baby in daycare is either easily or thoughtlessly done by most mothers. No, the fundamental reason why mothers of small children feel they cannot afford to stay home today, when a generation ago they didn't, is the greater prospect of divorce. The modern woman expects to support herself and knows the danger of being unable to do so. The fear a woman has of having to fend for herself and her children at some point underlies why even happily married women often feel obliged to work when there's no immediate financial reason for them to do so. So, Professor Warren says, this attitude reflects our collective common sense. If a woman stays in the workforce, she will gain experience and make more money. And if she makes more money, she will be better off if her husband leaves her, or so the argument goes. Once again, we focus on the circumstances of the middle-class family. There has been a great deal of news, much of it bad, about the plight of the low-income single mother, trapped in poverty, without a husband, with a limited education and dismal career prospects, garnering little support from the state, the community, or from the child's father. Chronically poor mothers have become the living symbols of the rough underside of the economy. But what about middle-class single mothers, women like Gail, who have a good education, substantial work experience, a decent income, and in most cases, an ex-husband solidly on the hook for child support? These women have followed the go-to-work prescription faithfully, making astounding gains in nearly every arena over the past generation, gains that should have translated into rising fortunes for the post-divorce family. What happened when millions of middle-class mothers beated into the workplace? The media tends to focus on the bad news, the shocking sexual harassment of a female employee, or antiquated policies that keep women out of prestigious military colleges and off fancy golf courses. The bad news makes for good headlines, but it shouldn't be allowed to overshadow one very important fact, and that is American women have come a very long way in a very short time. For example, the mantra of equal opportunity in the workplace has become so ingrained in our collective consciousness that it can be easy to forget the days a generation ago when the playing field wasn't nearly so level. Back in the 70s, there were two separate pay scales, one for men and one for women, and no one really even bothered to hide the fact that there were two separate pay scales. The differential was a matter of public record, and it produced little concern among either the public or the private sector. The policy was widely viewed as a normal feature of almost every family-friendly workplace. And we'll look more into this next week. This is bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak, and you have been listening to Life and Debt, your debt education program. If you have any questions or comments, call the station at 641-209-1083, or you can email me at lifeanddebt@gmail.com. I am speaking from Crew LP, 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa. May you enjoy and have a healthy and prosperous debt manageable life.